And then, in twos and threes and singly, wherever they landed and slithered down from 100-foot-high trees that they landed in, they saw men in loincloths coming out of the brush toward them, bearing machetes and blowpipes with spears on the end of them. And what happened next would determine whether the Yanks survived or not.
Welcome to Book Tour. I am Netta Ulaby. It's stranger than fiction this week as author Judith Hyman tells the real story of an event that took place in the final year of World War II. A tiny band of U.S. airmen shot down by the Japanese army parachuted onto Borneo and hoped for the best. They had no radio, no briefing materials. As Hyman says, all they knew of where they were could be summed up in a sideshow phrase. The wild men of Borneo had been headhunters, and perhaps some of them still were. Hyman says the airmen behaved like guests, not soldiers, and she says that may have saved them. They were fed, clothed, and hidden from the enemy until their rescue 7 months later. Judith Hyman talked about the airmen and the headhunters earlier this month at the Politics and Prose bookstore in Washington, D.C.
Thank you. I feel like this is your life. Everybody I've ever known in whatever context seems to be here today, and it's really quite a thrilling experience for me. I'm here to tell you, as you know, about my book, The Airmen and the Headhunters, which is a true story that took place in Borneo in the last year of World War II. In November 1944, a B-24 bomber, they called them Liberators, got shot up over Brunei Bay, just northwest of Borneo. We're talking about a place that's just southeast of the Indochinese Peninsula with Vietnam and so forth to figure out where it is. Mercator projections, unfortunately, shrink anything on the equator to about this size and expand Greenland so you think it's bigger than the whole continent. In fact, Borneo is the third largest island in the world, and it is enormous. Any case, their squadron had been briefed before taking off from eastern Indonesia across Borneo to Brunei Bay, and they'd been briefed that they would there to attack one or two Japanese vessels that had been sighted in the bay. But when they got there as part of the 23rd Squadron, they found the entire Japanese Pacific Fleet, what was left of it after the Battle of Leyte Gulf, was firing up at them. This bomber crew was one of the youngest in the Army Air Force, as it was then called, mostly under 20 years of age. Under 20. When the 8 surviving airmen jumped, their first parachute jump ever, they were scattered all over the canopy of the jungles of north-central Borneo, which looks from the air like nothing more than just fields and fields of broccoli is what it looks like from the distance you can see, with no space in between. The only officer still alive, able to jump after the naval guns of the Japanese had done their work, was the bombardier. He was one of the oldest. He was 21. He was Second Lieutenant Phil Corrin, and it was finding a wartime letter from him that got me started on tracking down this story. Afterwards, if you're interested, I'll read you that letter. Up to their landing in the middle of Borneo, these young airmen had been a very competent crew, fully up to the challenge of their job. But now, here they were, in a place that they'd practically never even heard about and knew nothing about, except that the natives had been and might still be notorious headhunters. As I said, the only officer still alive after the naval guns had done their job on them was this 21-year-old second lieutenant, Phil Corrin, and all he had to help him and his men survive in Borneo was a silk piece of cloth with a map on it. So this is what they had to go on in terms of where they were. They had this wonderful little book which says, Jungle, Desert, Arctic, and Ocean. You see, it's a big book, so it takes care of all of these eventualities. And this is, in fact, the edition of the book that they had. And it says wonderful things like, a man can live for weeks in the jungle with safety if he will avoid panic and use his head. Good food and good water are fairly plentiful in the jungle if you know where to look for them. And then they go on to describe wonderful things like lots and lots about coconut trees. There didn't happen to be any coconut trees at the elevations where they were, but never mind. And then if you read about the jungle natives, they suggested that deal with them by doing string tricks, because that you did when you were a kid. You know, this is almost a universal pastime, and this will be. I mean, I'm reading this, and then they said some intelligent things. This is in italics. Stay away from the women. And then they say, be particularly careful of your treatment of natives if you are in or near enemy territory. Eat native food only when it has been well and freshly cooked, and be sure all water offered you by the natives has been boiled. Under no conditions, sleep in or near native camps or bathe in nearby streams. Avoid close contact with any native. Don't go around barefoot. Okay? So that's what they have. Eventually, by the way, they found a use for this. If you look at the size of it, it's really perfect. If you cut it in half, you can make it into a deck of cards. And that's what they did with it. Remember, these folks had no radio. There weren't any battery radios, period. They had no briefing materials on Borneo, because nobody expected them to land there. And all they knew about the world's third biggest country could be summed up in the Barnum and Bailey circus phrase, the wild men of Borneo. These wild men had been headhunters until the mid to late 30s, and who knows, maybe some of them still were. And then, in twos and threes and singly, wherever they landed and slithered down from 100-foot high trees that they landed in, they saw men in loincloths coming out of the brush toward them, bearing machetes and blowpipes with spears on the end of them. And what happened next in these various places would determine whether the Yanks survived or not. And what they did instinctively turned out to be just the right thing. They threw down their weapons, offered their hands to the tribesmen, and these happened to be tribesmen who loved to shake hands. And the tribesmen led them to their village longhouses. A longhouse is a whole village in one great room, and in these tribes, didn't even have interior walls. So the whole village sees everything that's going on with everybody else under one roof, up on stilts. And when they got up, when they climbed up the logs with indentations in them for bare feet, they got up there and looked around, and they saw these thrillingly well-built, handmade houses. They saw hanging from the rafters human skulls. Nonetheless, realizing they had no choice, the airmen behaved like guests, not like soldiers, and they threw themselves on the mercy of these so-called savages. And in return, the tribespeople fed the airmen and hid them from the Japanese for over a seven-month period, and even clothed them when their clothes ran out in loincloths. I was fascinated to catch hints of the airmen's choice of words in how their attitudes toward their native hosts evolved over the 7 months they spent in Borneo. When the Yanks first spoke of their meetings with the tribes people, they would use such words as savages, jabbering in their native gibberish. But gradually and rather quickly, the airmen's word choice changes, even talking to me, reflecting a real change of attitude as they recognize the tribesmen's competence, courage, and kindness. The native people of Borneo in the interior, they didn't particularly want to attract the Japanese, who were mostly along the coast. And they had nothing to gain by helping these airmen, and a lot to lose. The Japanese would surely torture and kill them if they found that they had helped the Yanks. And in some of the areas, they did find they'd helped Yanks, and they did torture and kill them. But these particular Lundaya tribemen were talked into doing this, to helping the airmen, by their district officer, a Christian-educated Indonesian from a nearby island who'd been put in charge of the district by the Dutch colonial government and left in place when the Japanese came in 1942. This district officer, with a difficult name, William Makahanap, was, for various reasons, pro-Western, and by dint of long talks with the local headmen, he got their agreement to hiding the airmen. What happened was he heard the plane overhead, and then when he was told by some of the local people that the fugitives were in his district, he spent days, he got rounded up the heads of all the longhouses in his district, and spent days with them carefully laying out the problem of hiding the airmen and making clear that they knew the risks involved. And when the headmen asked him, "Who will win this war?" he had another question ready. "What if the Yanks win and we haven't helped them?" As a retired diplomat, I find his patience and skill quite take my breath away. But there was a wonderful irony in his efforts. Half the local people had been converted to evangelical Christianity just after the ban on headhunting had been enforced by the local government. And they had been taught that telling a lie, even for the best of reasons, even to save a life, would send them straight to hell when they died. So the district officer realized that he would have to ask the help of those tribal leaders who were not yet Christian, and who could lie if the Japanese or their spies asked about the Yanks. And they gladly did so. Indeed, they eventually went back to headhunting, abandoned before the war, but this time they took only Japanese heads. I found the evolving attitude of the airmen toward the tribesmen absolutely fascinating. From the horror they felt and expressed when they first saw those skulls of human heads dangling from the rafters, they came to see the respectful way the tribe's people treat such heads, which are a source of power and fertility for your crops, for your longhouse. If you manage to get one of your rivals' heads and bring it back and do all the correct ceremonies, it's a really powerful source of magic for you. I think my favorite scene in the book is when the Yanks, after months being hidden in a lonesome valley that they called Polecat Gulch and brought food at night, are back in the longhouse for their first headhunting celebration. Remember, the tribesmen are headhunters, not cannibals. In spite of travel writers to the contrary, I don't think there is a case of headhunters who are cannibals anywhere, and certainly not in Borneo. The Yanks were shown the special table settings for the aristocrats on a raised area in the center of the longhouse, which is the center is where the nobility hang out. And then the airmen were sent off to the ends where their dinner was served. And the Yanks that I talked to were not at all offended at not being asked to eat at the head table. After all, one of them said to me later, "We weren't aristocrats." I began to realize that the airman's story was only half the story, though. I speak Indonesian, and so was able, after I interviewed the surviving airmen, to go to northeast Borneo in 2003, thanks to a grant from the U.S. Indonesia Society. And there I met the surviving ex-headhunters. I remember interviewing one tribesman who'd been a young assistant pastor of the evangelical church there. And he and a bunch of other tribesmen had been placed by Makahanap to hide in the rushes poised to attack some Japanese soldiers who were crossing the river on their way to hunt for the airmen. And he confessed to me, these years and years later, in 2003, he told me he was very sorry, but at that last moment, he had found that he couldn't throw his spear because he'd heard that one of the Japanese was a Christian. But my favorite interview was with an old widow named Beenum. In 1945, she was 25 years old. She was 5'8" tall and very beautiful. And to rid the Americans of some of the Japanese who were staying near where the Americans were, Makahana had asked her to take off all her clothes, something the women of her tribe never ever did, not even in front of their husbands, and stand on a flat rock mid-river and lure the Japanese out to dance with her. It's Mari, Mari, Mari Dan Minari. And come, come, come and dance. While her husband Yakal and a few others crept behind and stole the Japanese soldiers' guns before coming up behind the soldiers with their machetes and lopping off their heads in the river. I had heard this story from others, but it was a great privilege to hear it from Beenum herself. And as we sat in her small wooden shack sipping orange squash, she said, "Now I've told you, I can go in peace to join my beloved Yakal." Given her ill health then, this is 4 years ago, I suspect she has joined Yakal by now. But I'm sure she'd be happy to know that her story had reached a wider audience. There's a lot more to this story in the book. For example, the airmen were eventually rescued and sent back to their base by the combined efforts of the local tribespeople, a mad British major, leading a small group of Australian guerrilla leaders who parachuted behind enemy lines to near where the airmen were hiding. The mad major asked the natives to build a bamboo airstrip. These are people who don't have the wheel. They have no wheeled vehicles. They built a bamboo airstrip in the middle of this jungle and convinced some daredevil Aussie pilots to fly into it with short takeoff and landing planes, sort of like a Piper Cub called an Auster, and take out the Yank airmen one by one in planes that could only take a pilot and one passenger, no parachutes, no radio for weight reasons, only fuel enough for the one-way trip across 200 miles of enemy-held jungle to the nearest liberated base. And they did it. The airmen never forgot the tribespeople of Borneo, and the tribespeople still remember them. The airmen speak of them with such veneration. Jim Nock, who was the flight engineer, and as a result of his job, he was the leading soldier of the crew. He would tell his wife, "You know, they call them savages, but they don't rape women, and they don't beat their wives, and they don't even hit their children under the age of 5, and then very rarely. And there are no old people left on their own. There are no orphans uncared for." And Dan Illerich, who's the only survivor still surviving, he lives in Texas. And when he went back, he was asked to speak at his church where his Boy Scout troop had met before the war, and he had been an Eagle Scout. And they asked him, "Dan, did you, your skills as an Eagle Scout, did they stand you in good stead?" And he looked at them straight in the eye and he said, "If it hadn't been for the native people, we would all have died, period." How the Dayaks remember things is also sort of interesting, because when I found I was having a problem because something wasn't working in the narrative, I would ask one of the tribespeople about it, and they would tell me the piece they knew, but they'd never written it down. It had never had what happens to us, which is that the written word replaces our memory and then becomes the fact for all purposes. It was still there in their heads the way it had happened then, without the things at the beginning, without what logically should have happened in the gaps, just the raw pieces of memory. And they gave me that. And when I plugged them in, they either made the narrative flow or they told me what was wrong with it. So their raw recollections of something that had happened so many years before were still really reliable. This is something they'll never forget and something that they had to be proud of. I think I've spoken enough. I'd love to hear from you. Any questions you have?
I'd love to hear the letter you mentioned.
It's dated April 3rd, 1945. And it was hand-carried by Maka Hanup to Tom Harrison, who was the Mad Major. April 3rd, 1945, Dear Sir, we just received word that there are seven of you who have landed in Borneo for the purpose of organizing the natives in warfare against the Japs. There are seven of us from a U.S. Army B-24, which was shot down November 16, and two from a Navy B-24 shot down January 13. There were, in fact, two others that he doesn't mention. We are staying with William Maka Hanup, a man from the Celebes who is district official for the Dutch in this area. Under his supervision, the natives here have killed all Japs that have come into this area. They are anxious to carry their warfare downriver and want you to come and help them. They need the help that modern warfare weapons can give them. And of course, we Americans would like very much to see you. Several of us are in need of medical aid, and naturally we would like to get out of here as soon as possible. We hope to see or hear from you. Sincerely yours, Philip R. Corin, Second Lieutenant, and his identification numbers. And then it's signed by eight of the others who were then there. And it was when I was holding this letter in my hands in an archive in Canberra, when I was working on a book about the Mad Major, that I thought, oh boy, there's really a story here.
What is it about the tribespeople?
The question is, what was there about their relation with the Japanese that made them decide to side with the Americans? I don't think it was actually their relation with the Japanese, except that the Japanese had, in 1942, come in and murdered the missionaries who'd been there, and their wives, and even their children. And so they certainly were frightened of the Japanese, but that might have had the other effect of, let's keep the Japanese out of our district. They're 2 days away. Let's keep it that way. But what really turned it around was Maka Hanup's diplomacy.
When you were picking up these oral memories, were some of them, was it being passed down from generation to generation?
Yes. Were the memories that I was getting from the Borneans being passed down to the children? I can't really answer that, because I basically was interviewing the people who had seen it themselves. It was some of them had been children at the time. I interviewed a number of Maka Hanup had taught school before he'd become the district officer. He'd been sent by his mission to open a school there, and so some of his students were there, and they recalled how he disciplined them and so forth and so on. But They had actually themselves been eyewitnesses, so I don't really know about the next generation.
Were the communities, the structure of the houses, and the sort of social structure similar to what the airmen described?
The question is, were these folks still living and behaving the way they had at the time that the airmen knew them? They were no longer living in longhouses. The Indonesian government encouraged them to be in single-family dwellings, the usual reason given being, and it certainly is true, that fires, when you break out in a single structure that has the whole village in it, can do a lot of damage, and it was fires that was the usual reason given. But it appeared to me, from the little time I was there, that the other aspects of the structure were still fairly strong. For example, Binum never had children, but there were young people around with her, obviously caring for her and regarding her as if she were a parent. And that's something that would have been true in the longhouse. Of course, it's physically much harder to do. I mean, wouldn't we all love to have grandma living in the house, looking after the babies so that we could go out to work? Well, that's what you had in a longhouse. And that wonderful structure is no longer there.
Why is the Mad Major the Mad Major?
Well, I wrote a whole book about that. Why is the Mad Major the Mad Major? I wrote a book about it, my first book. It's called... The title is The Most Offending Soul Alive, Tom Harrison and his remarkable story. And that title comes from Henry V. But if it be a sin to covet honor, I am the most offending soul alive. This was a polymath who did more things than we have time to talk about. And only one of the things he did was parachute into the middle of Borneo and raise an army of blowpiping, headhunting Dayaks against the Japanese that killed or captured 1,500 Japanese with no loss of his Australian operatives and only a handful of losses of the Dayaks. He also... discovered the oldest head of modern man up to that time. He also was a pioneer in ornithology, in protection of green sea turtles. He helped invent the way market research works. Yeah.
Is there any chance that your book will be translated into Indonesian?
Oh, I would really love that. Well, is there any chance that this book would be translated into Indonesian? That would be a great delight. Anybody who's got a friend who wants to do it.
What happened to Makahanap? Did he stay?
What happened to Makahanap? That's a very sad story, and I really, to read it in context, I suggest you read the book. But, you know, virtue isn't always rewarded.
His operation, their best radio operator, their number two doctor.
Yes, they really did. It was one, Peter was pointing out that these airmen, once they hooked up with the Mad Major's outfit, were put to use. The man who still survives, he was the number two radio operator for them for all the time that he was there. And he insisted on being the last one out because he wanted to be working at the radio till the last minute. So they definitely did that. And also, in a way, they helped with the operation because the Mad Major made an advantage of what he'd seen with the airmen. The airmen were forced, because they were alone and ones and twos and threes, to eat the local food, use local gestures, walk barefoot, hunt the way the local people did. And so when Harrison got there with his crowd, he, to their everlasting fury, gave them, his people, his Australians, he gave them no food. He said, you go in no more than two of at a time. You live with these people. You eat what they eat. You do what they do. And he said, I don't have any food for you. He was lying when he said that. But his feeling was, first of all, with the White Australia policy, if you got a bunch of Australians together and they were reinforced in what they'd been raised to believe about other peoples, they'd all be killed. And secondly, he felt that if these operatives couldn't make the local people like them enough to feed them, they were as good as dead anyway. So in a sense, the experience of our airmen and the confirmation of that by the Mad Major created a new kind of approach to guerrilla warfare that is still being used. When we succeed, it's still being used today. Did any of the airmen rejoin the war? Yes, certainly Dan Illerich did. He ended up a lieutenant colonel. Yes.
Did any of the Americans have extraordinary lives after the war?
Did any of the Americans have extraordinary lives after the war? I don't think in ways that would sort of make the paper or anything, but certainly everybody who was in their circle of friends and family ended up with a much more nuanced approach to the world than these folks had started out with. They didn't end up feeling that what we do is necessarily always the best thing because we do it. And they just had a more open-minded approach to the world, and they pass that on to their friends and neighbors.
How long did it take them to cut up the survival manual?
How long did it take them to cut up the survival manual? Well, I think they did it very shortly after they got to Polecat Gulch.
One more thing. Can I ask you to read your article, your letter to the editor?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, these things happen. The International Herald Tribune today published an op-ed letter that I wrote, and it's entitled, Guests Can Succeed Where Occupiers Fail. As at least one federal agency has confirmed, the United States is failing to have a major influence on sectarian and tribal leaders in Iraq. In fact, our huge footprint in Iraq and Afghanistan may be hurting us more than it helps. That irony came to light recently when I was researching a book about the Allies' special operations in Borneo during World War II. There, in early 1945, 11 stranded U.S. airmen helped a few dozen Australian special operatives transform some of the inland tribesmen of Borneo into a 1,000-man headhunting army. The army of tribesmen killed or captured some 1,500 Japanese soldiers while suffering a negligible number of casualties. They also provided behind-the-lines intelligence that helped the Allies seize oil fields that were crucial to Japan's war-fighting capacity. By the way, Japan got 40% of its oil from Borneo during World War II. How did so few manage to accomplish so much? Ironically, it may be the fact that they were so few that led them to succeed. The 11 Yanks, aged 18 to 22, were shot down by the enemy as they tried to attack a nearby Japanese fleet. They had never expected to end up in Borneo, the world's third biggest island composed mostly of impenetrable jungle. Cut off entirely from the outside world, the airmen quickly learned enough of the local language to discover that these tribespeople, the Dayaks, had been headhunters only a decade or so earlier. Despite whatever misgivings this created, the airmen recognized that their only hope for survival was to trust these Dayaks, and to behave like polite guests in their longhouses and to accept the authority of the Dayak leadership. They ate the Dayak food, however unpalatable, were courteous to all and chaste with regard to the women. They won the goodwill of people who knew that anyone found harboring Allied airmen could be tortured and killed by the occupying Japanese. When the airmen were able to return home after more than half a year, using a bamboo airstrip the Dayaks had helped them build, they left behind them a good name that serves us well still in the recollections of later generations of Dayaks. I came to learn these facts in the course of writing a book about these stranded airmen, and now as I read the newspapers, I cannot help noticing how in today's unconventional wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, our soldiers and leaders' current lack of success in co-opting the local people contrasts with what was achieved by a small number of American airmen 60-odd years ago. How come the difference, and what can we learn from it? The difference may well be directly related to the numbers of soldiers involved. The airman who was the quickest to learn the local language and to become a competent survivor was the one who was alone in a Dayak village for months before meeting up with any of the other Americans, the slowest to become capable of helping themselves and being part of an effective anti-Japanese unit were those in the biggest group, 4 American flyers. Think about it. When do you learn a language most easily? When you have no choice. There is no place on the planet where today's soldier can be as free of daily contact with his or her home country. Even if the soldiers were alone in an Afghan or Iraqi village, they'd still be electronically tethered to the world they came from. By the same token, the hosts can no longer meet Americans without preconceptions, as could the Dayaks of 1945. The Iraqis and Afghanis have all formed images of America from movies and television, at the least. We cannot roll back time, but when operating in fragile societies to combat foreign or domestic extremist minorities, we can try to keep our footprints smaller, and we can try to restore the good name of our country around the world by holding to our true values, so that the image projected abroad of the United States is not of a ruthless conqueror, but of a caring friend.
Thanks for joining us on Book Tour. For more talks like this one, please go to npr.org/booktour.